From 90.9 WBUR, I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. MIT today released a report on its involvement with Jeffrey Epstein, saying it violated no policy because no policy was in place. An architect of the Iran nuclear deal on where it stands today.
The question now is, in the wake of the Soleimani events, where will Iran go now in terms of its next steps away from the agreement?
And it's Friday, so it's Week in Review. Iran, impeachment, and Boston Mayor Marty Walsh's big plans for the city in 2020.
Our city and our residents are the largest taxpayers into the MBTA. This is Boston, and we've never been big fans of taxation without representation. You deserve a voice.
We'll take your calls next on Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. And moments ago, MIT released the results of an investigation into its relationship with convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein, who died in federal prison last August. We have WBUR's Fred Tice here to tell us more about it. Fred, welcome back.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So just some context. This comes after a huge upheaval last fall around Epstein's relationship with MIT. The head of the media lab resigned. There were campus protests. I think that led to this report. I know you're still combing through the documents, but what have you learned so far?
Well, one thing that jumps out is that the report says that since MIT had no policy or any processes for handling controversial donors in place at the time that these donations of $850,000 were made, the decision to accept the post-conviction donations from Jeffrey Epstein can't be judged to be a policy violation. But the report says it's clear that the decision was the result of collective and significant errors in judgment that resulted in serious damage to the MIT community. The report out today blames Professor Seth Lloyd, he's a mechanical engineering professor, for allowing Epstein to visit the campus and for taking Epstein's money. And today's report concludes that Lloyd purposefully failed to inform MIT that Epstein had given him two donations to support his research. The report also says Lloyd received a personal gift of $60,000 from Epstein in either 2005 or 2006, which Lloyd acknowledged but did not report to MIT. Now, we've reached out to Lloyd. We have not yet heard back from him.
What about the president of MIT, Fred, and other senior leadership there?
Well, the report concludes that President Raphael Reif of MIT did not know that the Institute was receiving donations from a convicted sex offender. But the report also finds that there were three MIT vice presidents who were aware of Epstein's donations, and they did know he was a convicted sex offender. Now, Epstein's, for those listeners who don't follow this story that closely, died in a New York jail cell last year. The New York medical examiner ruled his death a suicide. According to today's report, he visited MIT nine times between 2013 and 2017. But senior leadership at MIT did not know that. And the other person the report blames for Epstein's campus visits and MIT's acceptance of these gifts is the former director of MIT's media lab, Joy Ito. And again, we've reached out to him. We have not heard back from him.
Okay, so has MIT responded?
They are going to have a conference call, in a couple of hours.
And they'll let us know more then.
I would imagine, yeah.
All right. Now, no policy was violated because there was no policy. Does the report address the ethical dilemma or the maybe low bar that suggests?
Not that I can see. It just says that there was an error in judgment on the part of, several people at MIT.
Okay. And you've said some pretty stunning things about this tenured faculty member, Seth Lloyd. We know Joy Ito resigned in September. Has there been any consequence or next step for Seth Lloyd at this point?
So MIT's president, Raphael Reif, is placing him on leave. Now, I'll go back into the report a little further. Professor Lloyd knew that donations from Epstein would be controversial and that MIT might reject them, and concludes that in concert with Epstein, he purposefully decided not to alert the Institute to Epstein's criminal record, choosing instead to allow mid-level administrators to process these donations without any formal discussion or diligence concerning Epstein.
Okay, and in our last minute or so, implications for the institution itself, MIT, and for the Media Lab?
Just a few minutes ago, I received an email from a biology professor at MIT, Nancy Hopkins, who says it's good that the report is finally out and that MIT can move on.
All right, WBUR reporter Fred Tice, thanks for the quick turnaround on this.
Thanks, Tiziana.
So today we have a chance to get a perspective that very few people could give us on what it means to be out of the Iran nuclear deal. Here in Studio 3 is former Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz. He was a key architect of the Iran nuclear deal. He's professor emeritus at MIT and co-chair of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that works to reduce global threats. Secretary Moniz, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you, Tiziana.
Now, we're going to talk Iran, but you are a professor emeritus at MIT. You just heard our conversation with Fred Tice about the university's report on its relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. Do you have any reactions?
Well, first of all, I've been at MIT, in fact, for 43 years or something like that. I certainly know nothing about this report other than what I just heard now. But let me say, well, first of all, I do want to emphasize, I think what we all feel, the Epstein saga is one pretty sorry tale, particularly from the point of view of all the victims that unfortunately suffered at his hands. As far as MIT goes, I'll be very curious to read the report. But I do want to say from my perspective of being so long at MIT, one thing I've always admired at MIT, it's a problem-solving culture. A problem comes up. You face it. You don't hide from it. I trust that will be the same reaction here. And clearly, steps have been taken and must be taken to make sure this kind of thing does not happen again.
Mm. All right. Let's turn to Iran. The latest today, Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo announced increased sanctions. Here's Pompeo.
The goal of our campaign is to deny the regime the resources to conduct its destructive foreign policy. We want Iran to simply behave like a normal nation. We believe the sanctions that we impose today further that strategic objective.
Pompeo also said today that the U.S. isn't going to discuss Iraq's demand that the U.S. begin the process of withdrawing troops from that country at their parliament's request. What do you believe is the goal of the sanctions that were announced today?
Well, I believe the goal of the sanctions is just what Secretary Pompeo said, to further reduce their income streams. It's worth, by the way, in this context, to note that Iran's economy has never been an oil economy in the sense of, say, Saudi Arabia. It's always been a much smaller part of their income, but an important part, clearly. The sanctions are clearly hurting. But I must say I cannot agree with the Secretary that this approach is one that will fundamentally change their regional behavior, which we need to change.
Especially
well, because they have been supporting these proxies, et cetera, for a long time. They've done it when the original sanctions were biting into their economy. Frankly, supplying some rockets to various paramilitary forces, proxy forces, is not all that expensive, to put it bluntly.
But didn't the Obama administration argue that sanctions were part of what brought Iran to the
Absolutely.
Table for the 25th? So why are they a bad
Absolutely.
Idea this time if they weren't then?
Oh, no, I'm not saying that they are a bad idea from the point of view of biting into Iran's behavior. What I'm saying is I don't think that it was the sanctions that caused, in fact, some improvement for a while in the regional behavior. It's because we had diplomacy. And in the current situation where the tensions are so high, mistakes are made, like, for example, the tragedy with the Ukrainian airliner. And we've had our own mistakes in the past along these lines. In this kind of a situation, crisis management, open channels of communication, relationships are what really matter. Now's the time when you really need them. The maximum pressure campaign is not being accompanied, in my view, by an appropriate diplomatic thrust.
On that tragedy of the airliner, it's a Boeing 737. It crashed shortly after takeoff on Wednesday. 176 people on board were killed. The U.S. and its allies believe it was taken down by an Iranian missile. Iran invited the National Transportation Safety Board to aid in an investigation about the crash. Will today's increased sanctions inhibit that cooperation or the investigation?
I don't know. We will see. I was a little bit surprised by the original invitation, although that is...
Why? Why is that surprising?
Well, because of the tensions that we have right now. Certainly, it's very important that Iran invite external parties who are expert in analyzing these kinds of events. And it is traditional and I think required by international agreement that, for example, the manufacturer of the plane, Boeing in this case, would be part of the investigation, et cetera. So I personally hope that Iran just follows the normal course of events. You know, we had a similar situation, obviously, in 2014 with the Malaysian flight shot down over over Ukraine. And once the forensics were done, it was completely clear that it was a surface-to-air missile. Almost certainly, I mean, it's got to be the same result here. But you really want to be on the ground and look at those forensics.
We're talking to former Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz, one of the architects of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Let's talk about, I don't know if you call it the remains of the deal or where the deal stands now. Shortly after General Qasem Soleimani was killed, Iran essentially claimed it was going to respect no limits on its ability to enrich uranium anymore. It was a multi-party deal in 2015. U.S. pulled out. But where does the rest of the deal stand as of now?
So, first of all, Tiziana, I think it's important to say briefly what the deal is, very briefly, namely two components. One component was very stringent constraints on what Iran could do in the nuclear space for 15 years, and then even more important, an unprecedented verification regime, giving tools to the international inspectors that they have nowhere else in the world. And when all is said and done, and I said this right from day one of having reached the agreement, the verification regime is the more important because if Iran is to pursue a nuclear weapon, and they had a program up to 2003, there's no question about that, really. But if they are to pursue it, it's not going to be in one of the declared facilities. It's going to be a covert program. And so the inspection regime is the foundation of confidence in the international community in Iran not pursuing a nuclear weapon.
All right, so where does the inspection regime stand?
Yeah, and so exactly. So today what's important to understand is that the first part of the agreement, they have said we are no longer bound by any constraint there, although one – it's a very slim, maybe glimmer of hope. Is that the foreign minister Zarif, after the Soleimani killing, did emphasize that all the steps they've taken on the nuclear side are in fact reversible. And if the deal,
why would one emphasize something like that?
I think it's a signal of we're willing to talk. If you, the six countries, including the United States, who are signatories, and the EU as well, respect your obligations, we will go back and fully respect our nuclear obligations.
So do you read that as Iran hoping to get the U.S. back to the table, to put the U.S. back in the 2015 deal?
I think they have been consistent in saying that we will engage in discussions with the United States if we reset to where we were.
Now,
in other words, it would require President Trump to say, okay, we will also go back and waive the sanctions that have been put in place that were part of the deal, and Iran would go back to full compliance with the agreement.
Now, there were criticisms of where we were. So, for example, the sanctions were lifted in response to a nuclear deal, but they had covered broader behavior than just the development of a nuclear weapon.
Right.
The sanctions were lifted indefinitely, but the deal itself covered a 10 to 15 year time frame in terms of monitoring Iran's behavior. Is that a table we want to go back to, or is there an opportunity, since I think what you're saying is that the nuclear capability development side is the side that Iran has walked away from? Would this be an opportunity to strengthen those aspects?
Certainly. But I do want to emphasize one thing. The deal does not go away in 15 years. The nuclear constraints on peaceful nuclear activities go away.
But that's a big deal.
But the verification does not go away. And again, the verification is the most important part. So, again, I don't want to be Pollyannish here. We're not in a good place, okay? But the reality is today, and they repeated it, although it's what they do, which is more important than the words, but they did repeat it, that they will continue to work with the international inspectors as required in the agreement. And frankly, we know that the international inspectors, the IAEA, has confirmed that Iran has been fully cooperating on the verification side. So we don't want to lose track of that very important part.
Is the IAEA known to be effective in applying constraints by being there to observe and report? I mean, are there critics out there that I don't know about because this is not my core area of expertise who would say, yeah, but the IAEA doesn't have enough teeth and so that doesn't give me the comfort I would want?
What I would say is what the JCPOA, what the Iran agreement did, is give the inspectors many more teeth. Again, they have capabilities here, 24/7 surveillance of all of these facilities, an ability to inspect the entire uranium supply chain. They have that nowhere else in the world.
Do you think those teeth are sharp enough with Iran?
Yes. I do.
Why?
Because, again, what really concerns me, first of all, there's no doubt that the technologies that are being used, the access that they have, the doubling, almost doubling of the number of inspectors, tremendous for the existing Iranian complex. But I keep going back. What I think is more important in the end is making sure that through intelligence, through observations, that any suspicions about covert activities, they can go and inspect anywhere. That does not guarantee. A serious technical person would never say, I'm 100% sure we will find anything they'll do. But what I will say, and our head of intelligence in 2015 said, it raises the bar on getting caught very, very high. And if they get caught again trying covert activity on a nuclear weapon, the international community will come down again on them even harder.
Based on what you know, having been in sustained engagement with Iran, how badly do they want a nuclear weapon and why?
I think that there is it's completely a subjective issue today. There is no question, as I said earlier, that they had a weapons development program through 2003. Everyone has concluded, and by the way, it's consistent with the Israeli information trove, that there's no evidence of an organized weapons program since that time, number one. Number two, there is something that we don't understand really, and that is that they did all of this work around developing the nuclear weapons technologies through 2003, and yet had done nothing to develop the nuclear weapons material that you would need to have a weapon.
But they just said a few days ago, all bets are off. We're going to develop the core of what that material would be, right?
No, so now, if without these constraints, they start to develop again and deploy the technology that could be used to develop that weapons material. That's why it's so important to have these end-to-end inspections that follow the material and make sure there is no diversion of material, et cetera. So, you know, again, I'm certainly not being Pollyannish here. We're not in a good place, but we don't want to lose the perspective that we still do have a functioning verification regime and that so far there is no evidence of their restoring any kind of nuclear weapons development program.
We're talking to former U.S. Secretary of Energy Ernest Moniz, who was an architect of the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. I want to talk sort of bigger strategic. President Trump spoke about our relations with Iran Wednesday after Tuesday night's retaliation. Here he is.
As long as I'm president of the United States, Iran will never be allowed to have a nuclear weapon.
Okay, he walked right up to the podium, and those were the first words out of his mouth. How big of a strategic threat in the strategic threat landscape is Iran's ambition for nuclear arms, or is Iran? Because I know there are two different things going on there.
First of all, let me say that it was good of the president to repeat President Obama's policy.
I see what you did there.
To repeat President Bush's policy. Every president of the United States is committed to Iran not having a nuclear weapon. The difference is, frankly, in the Obama administration, we ended up negotiating the deal that took the nuclear weapon off the table. And the strategy more broadly, and this is where there's a divergence, obviously, the strategy was, and again, I've said this before, very, very much like President Reagan in the Cold War. He negotiated arms control agreements with the Soviet Union while we had all kinds of problems with them in many ways. So our philosophy was, the president's philosophy was, President Obama's philosophy was, same way, let's get the nuclear weapon off the table convincingly in ways that can be verified, and then let's not let up. Let's actually increase the pressure to solve our problems with Hezbollah, with Syria, with Yemen, with human rights, with missiles, et cetera. So that was the approach. That was the foundation for doing more. Now, here, instead, all that's been thrown off the table. We have more uncertainty about a possible nuclear weapons trajectory. And at some point, that can lead to a slippery slope of other miscalculations being made.
Okay, I want to push back to that a little bit, because we had Joel Brenner, former Inspector General of the National Security Agency, also in the Obama administration, also now at MIT. He was on earlier this week, and he said he believes President Trump's initial drone strike might actually work.
This could work. This could work.
You've said this could work a couple of times, which is really interesting. What does it look like if it's working?
It means that the Iranians won't attack shipping in the Gulf, that they'll draw in their claws throughout the region, and won't attack our forces.
So what do you think of that?
Clearly, it could work and it could not work. We don't know. The issue is, and I see, I'm not even touching the issue, military justification of eliminating Soleimani, et cetera. He was a declared terrorist in the United States. The issue is always, what's the risk-reward? And this was certainly a risky endeavor. And what the rewards are or the downfalls are, we don't know yet. We will see. What we know is the first response by Iran, and some argue whether it was intentional or not, but obviously it avoided, the practicality is it avoided casualties. And that could be a de-escalating approach. But we won't know until we see if there is a further campaign by Iran. The thing we have to avoid, and this is where diplomacy comes in, we have to avoid the tit-for-tat spiraling that just keeps escalating until one has potentially even a full-out military confrontation, which would not end well for anybody, including us.
All right. That's Ernest Moniz, former Secretary of Energy, professor emeritus at MIT, and co-chair of the Nuclear Threat Initiative, a nonprofit, nonpartisan organization that works to reduce the dangers of weapons of mass destruction. Thanks for being with us on Radio Boston today.
Thank you. I hope it was helpful.
Stay tuned. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It's Friday, so it's time for Week in Review. In Studio 3 here is Arlene Isaacson, president of Isaacson Political Consulting and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Welcome back, Arlene.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Also with us is Joe Battenfeld, a political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Welcome back, Joe.
Thanks for having me.
And you're with us, so call. Pull up a chair at the kitchen table. What did you think of what you heard from Ernest Moniz, the latest on Iran? What about the president's war powers and where we stand on impeachment? Call us. What do you make of it all? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation. Let me just start with reactions to what we just heard from Ernest Moniz, former Secretary of Energy. Obviously, a very specific perspective on Iran and the nuclear deal. Joe?
Well, obviously, he's the expert on this, but I thought it was interesting that he did not say that the killing of Soleimani was not necessarily would not work, that he agreed that it's possible that it could force Iran to the table and, you know, cause a de-escalation of the conflict.
So, Arlene, that means that Radio Boston has had two former Obama administration officials on this week acknowledging that it's possible that the president's approach here with the drone strike on Soleimani could work. Do you think that that's an idea that's getting broad attention or traction with the American people, and should it?
I think that I have a lot of respect for Ernest Moniz and the work that he's done in the diplomatic arena. So his opinion carries with me great, great weight. And any time you can achieve something diplomatically, I'm inclined to think that it's a better idea than not. The past week, I've learned that two previous presidents, both Obama and Bush, had to confront this very question about Soleimani and whether they should take
it out. Whether
they
should do it.
And that in each case, they did a cost-benefit analysis and decided that killing him would be as bad, if not worse, than letting him live. And so the question is, does that same calculus apply now?
And do you think it does?
I have no idea.
So, and isn't that where we are to some extent as an American
people? Well, but the thing is, yes, we don't know. But the problem that we face is this. There's a public policy question involved, of course. But then there's a question of who it is that you believe. And when you're dealing with a president who has a very bad track record of lying, it makes it a lot harder to trust his views and his facts, as the things that he says are facts.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Join our panelists. Be part of this conversation. We're interested in what you think. Joe, what's your response to what Arlene just said?
Yeah, I think in general, the American people want to support a president at times like this, but I think those times may be gone because of what happened in Iraq and what happened in Afghanistan, that people are just kind of fed up with that and, you know, the prolonged conflicts there. And so they may not. The country is so polarized right now that it's going to come down. It's this question itself is polarizing, whether the killing of Soleimani was appropriate or not. So I think the country is split on that, as well as it is on a number of things.
Well, you know, we went through something similar when W. Bush was president, and he used WMDs, you know, the weapons of mass destruction, and used that as the justification for attacking Iraq. And at that time, there was a bipartisan support. Many of the Democrats now regret supporting him.
But they did.
But they were willing to do it. And there's reason to not feel the same way with this particular president, given his track record.
So I want to ask you, you know, we're here in Boston. The three of us are not big, you know, Washington, D.C. policy experts, but we're American citizens. We're voters. And on Wednesday, we all heard the president come to the podium and talk after this retaliation Tuesday night. And he said two things. The tit for tat seems to be done, and we are hitting Iran with new sanctions. Joe, what was your reaction to the president's speech?
I think, like most people, kind of breathe a sigh of relief that things weren't getting out of control, because I think there was a real fear that, you know, with what happened with Iran striking back, that it would escalate with Trump then doing something. The fact that Trump did not strike back, I think, was heartening to a lot of people who, like I said, do not want a war with Iran. It's clear the American people do not want that. I don't think the Iranian government wants it. I don't think, actually, the U.S. government wants that either.
Arlene, what did he need to do, and did he do it?
Well, you know, in some ways, I think that Trump was lucky. Lucky that when the Iranians hit the base, that they didn't kill any Americans.
Why? Thank God. Why do you say that?
Well, because I think we'd be looking at a very different calculation if they had. And they destroyed property at our air base.
And
they didn't kill any Americans.
Do you think that was by design?
I don't know. But I do know that to me, the threshold question is, are we safer now that they've actually taken out Soleimani? And if you look at some of the results of this killing, we've got the U.S. that's being thrown out of Iraq, which is going to help ISIS. We've got Iran restarting its nuclear weapons program. We've got Iranian citizens who were protesting their government previously, and now they're supporting it. And you've got Iran saying that they're going to vow for future revenge. We don't know what kind. that doesn't make me feel safer.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK to join the conversation, which Eric from Woburn is going to do. Eric, what's on your mind?
Hi, yes. So I just think of one of the consequences of killing Soleimani was that he was known for fighting ISIS. And now that he's gone, it seems like ISIS now has a place to kind of grow, because there really is no plan for the Middle East. At least to me, it seems like that. And that's pretty much all I got. Thank you.
So, Eric, thanks for that call. And that gets to Arlene's point, Joe, about are we safer now or not with this step? It does seem that activities against ISIS have been suspended, and our relationship, our military relationship with Iraq, is at least on the rocks right now. So how do you think about that?
It's too soon to tell, really. I think there is an argument to be made that the killing of Soleimani will eventually, overall, make us safer, because the fact that before this attack happened, what happened is Iran organized these protests, and you know, at the U.S. embassy, and you know, which was a very dangerous situation, and things were escalating out of control there. So I think, you know, the fact that things haven't escalated beyond, you know, Iraq just doing that, whether it was purposeful or not, I'm not sure. But I don't really trust Iran was trying not to do damage. You know, the fact that they shot down an airliner, too, indicates their general ineptness, I think.
All right. So this is one of those weeks where we have unlimited topics to cover, but we do not have unlimited time. So we're going to turn our talk to impeachment now. Listeners, call us at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Or tweet us at Radio Boston. Is it time to go through the impeachment trial in the Senate? And what do you expect from that trial? So Speaker Nancy Pelosi said yesterday Here's what she said yesterday about when she might send the articles over to the Senate.
I'll send them over when I'm ready. And that will probably be soon. We want to see what they're willing to do and the manner in which they will do it. But we will not let them say, oh, this is just like Clinton, fair is fair. It's not.
So apparently she's ready, because today she announced that next week they're going over. Is it time?
Well, it looks like she's backing down to me. I mean, she was hoping that there would be this pressure campaign on the Trump administration that somehow withholding the articles of impeachment would actually help Democrats' cause. I don't see how it's helped Democrats' cause at all. The American people are sort of tuning out of impeachment already because of it.
Arlene, do you agree with that?
No, actually, I don't. I think that there has been a collateral benefit to her delaying it. I think it's allowed to it exposes the Senate for the sham trial that it will be, that Mitch McConnell is not even pretending that there'll be any degree of impartiality. And very importantly, it's allowed more time for more information to come forward, the possibility of more information, the possibility of more witnesses like John Bolton saying, oh, yeah, if I'm subpoenaed, I would come and testify.
Do either of you think there's anybody who felt one way about impeachment, but as a result of this delay, feels differently about it now on either side?
Maybe the fact that they're sick of it now more than they were before, just because of all this gamesmanship going on. And, you know, people are kind of wondering why there's been this delay when they had, you know, the House impeachment vote. And if things were so urgent that they had to impeach him, then why are we waiting 2 weeks?
I don't blame someone if we reduced it to a local level issue. And if the police thought that they could get more information before going to trial, they would. It'd be crazy not to. And I think she was smart to try.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Melissa from Watertown, jump on in here.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. I think that my sentiments echo your guest when she made the point that Donald Trump does lie, and that puts us in all kinds of trouble. We just can't trust what he's doing and what he's saying and what his motivations are. I also think that even though everybody can agree that Soleimani was a bad guy, killing him only and with that huge display of distressed citizens is only going to create more terrorists in the future. And I think that we would have been much better to continue down a road of diplomacy, because ultimately I think that
I've got a lot of callers, so we got a couple ideas there from you. Thank you. I want to put one more caller on the line. We've got Michael from Everett. Michael, jump in.
Hey, I just want to say that at this point, you know, if the Senate's not going to give a fair trial, they're not going to give a fair trial. Fine. Give it to them. Have them not do a fair trial. There's more information coming out all the time. See another impeachment. And the other thing I just want to point out, if anyone hasn't seen the movie, go watch the movie Wag the Dog. And then think about what's going on with
De Niro and Pacino. Stuff. All right, so let me just ask you, Joe, what's your reaction to the rinse and repeat argument?
Well, I don't know. I'm not sure if that's going to work or not, really, the rinse and repeat, because, you know, people are, like I said, people are kind of getting fed up with the whole impeachment saga, I think, and want Washington to move on.
Okay, so one more question on this, and then we will move on. Arlene, what is fair? So we're hearing a lot about Mitch McConnell saying fair is fair. This is the same as Clinton. That's fair. Nancy Pelosi saying I'm not going to let them get away with fair is fair. There's a lot of back and forth about witnesses. For the average person, what would a fair impeachment trial look like?
It's a very interesting question. I found it fascinating what Nancy Gertner said the other day about how she described the phenomenon of the House is like a grand jury. They're the ones that make the accusation. The Senate is then trying the accusation. And the facts matter. And the fact that the Senate would not allow witnesses or even evidence to come in is kind of gobsmacking to any person who knows about the trial system in a traditional context. So I think it sort of highlights the fact that there's going to be a lot of theater involved in this, a lot more theater than reality, in fact.
Okay, I'm getting ready to go to a break. But before I do, let's give a listener the last word on this. We've got Kathy from Cape Cod. Kathy, go ahead.
Hi. I actually just want to make a point about Nancy Pelosi and that the delay in putting the impeachment forward. And she made it very clear what her delay was about. She wanted to ensure that it would be a fair practice. And she basically said to the Senate, please show me what your plans are for an impeachment trial, and I'd be happy to hand this over. She said it a number of times. I don't know why it acts like it's such a mystery for everyone, like she's somehow holding on to this golden egg. She's not. She wants to make sure there's a fair Senate hearing.
Kathy, I love the golden egg imagery. We're going to go to a break on that image. It can hang out there for everyone. Arlene Isaacson, president of Isaacson Political Consulting. Stick around. Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Stick around. Listeners, stick around. There's more ahead. I'm Tiziana Deering. This is Radio Boston's Week in Review. Welcome back to Radio Boston's Week in Review. I'm Tiziana Deering. Before the break, we did Iran and impeachment, but we are shifting gears. It is time for State of the City. Still here in Studio 3 to help me talk about it is Arlene Isaacson, political consultant and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus, and Joe Battenfeld, a political columnist at the Boston Herald. He's host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. And you, so call us. Did you listen to the State of the City address this week? The mayor had three big priorities: transportation, education, housing. What's important to you and what do you want to see from the mayor in 2020? 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. So, Arlene, those three big priorities, what do you want to do first?
Well, housing and transportation. Well, they're all critically
housing
important.
Housing it is. You win.
All right.
Let's start with housing. What do you think?
The middle class is being just locked out of the middle and lower class and working class folks are being locked out of the city. And so I appreciate the fact that he's going to focus more on that. Unfortunately, like every other issue that he mentioned, almost every single thing depends on the state, whether it's state lawmakers or the governor, to get it done right and effectively. And so we're beholden to the legislature and the governor to step up.
So, Joe, you nodded and every head in the control room nodded on everything belonging. It depends on the state. Say some more about
that.
Well,
I find it interesting that Marty Walsh was a former legislator, and he's the one who's now sort of passing the buck to the legislature, saying you have to do this.
You think he's passing the buck?
I do think he's several times he mentioned it, not just on housing, on transportation as well. He was urging the state take action on that too. And in fact, he could do more to pressure the legislature than he's doing now. And I think the legislature has traditionally taken a not very fond look toward cities that try to do home rule petitions. They generally look down on those.
So let's anchor for our listeners who didn't hear the address on Tuesday night what Marty Walsh said about housing.
Rents and home prices are stabilizing, but they're still too high for too many people. There's much more work to be done. So tonight, I'm announcing an unprecedented investment, $500 million over 5 years to create thousands of homes all across our city, affordable to a range of incomes from our most vulnerable to the middle class.
Now, Governor Charlie Baker was sitting right in the front row there. It's not like he wasn't getting the message from Marty Walsh. But Arlene, what he just said is stuff that's pretty much in the city's purview to do. So are you questioning the mayor's ability to do what he just said there?
Yeah, there's an important caveat, which is that the city can only raise a certain amount of money because of Prop 2.5, the constraint on property tax increases. Other than that, they are dependent in large part on local aid from the state. And so unless the legislature is willing to give it and the governor willing to sign it and spend it, the city can only do so much.
Now, he also had revenue ideas, though, selling the Lafayette garage and the 2% transfer tax on real estate sales over $2 million. You have this look on your face
The Lafayette garage was really not meant for that. It could be used for other things, you know, as just going into the general fund as opposed to this. I think he kind of stole that and put it in there to make it look like he was adding more money to the table.
So, one of the things that he talked about in housing was this idea that the city would provide city-funded vouchers for people to get housing. My first reaction to that was, oh, right, the city doesn't fund those now. But my second reaction was, will that grow the number of people who receive vouchers, or will that create almost a substitution value where other sources of funding, like state-level funding, might eventually dry up? Can the city really add over and above? Arlene?
It's an interesting question. There's always been a program called Section 8, but it was very unpopular in certain neighborhoods and certainly by people who owned homes that rented out some of that space to apartment dwellers. I think one of the issues that the state has to grapple with and allow is some local option for rent control, because that'll affect all the cities and towns that choose to go for it again.
Yeah, Marty Walsh didn't bring up rent control on Tuesday night, but he was on our show recently and he did address it.
We're looking at everything right now in the city. We're looking at what does rent control mean? I think a lot of people are afraid of rent control because of the name rent control. There's different forms of rent control now in the country. We're at a drastic point in time to think about how do we allow people the opportunity to stay in the city of Boston, live in the city of Boston.
What's your reaction to that, Jeff?
I think he's getting pressure by other city councilors on this issue, and he's feeling the pressure. The fact that he's even open to rent control says that, because in the past this has been anathema to a lot of politicians, a rent control argument. And I think the fact that he wants to be bold, he said bold about 12 times in that speech. Just because you say bold doesn't mean you are bold. If he really wanted to be bold, he would have embraced some form of rent control.
1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Should the mayor have embraced rent control in the State of the City on Tuesday night? Do you think his proposals for housing, education, and transportation were bold? Is he moving the ball forward in your mind? Call us and share your thoughts. Joe, I'm going to come back to you because Arlene got first pick and she picked housing. So what do you pick?
Transportation, was the biggest issue on most people's minds.
And what do you want to talk about from that, from what you heard Tuesday night?
Well, again, he's relying a bit on the state to do more. In fact, he was urging the state to do more and be bold like the city was being bold. Which I think is a good thing. I believe Speaker DeLeo was at the speech. I'm not sure, but I saw him there. I think that seemed to be aimed at Speaker DeLeo, which the city, which many people believe the state is not acting fast enough on transportation measures.
Do you think the state is acting fast enough?
I do. I do. I think, fast enough means is maybe a gas tax. That DeLeo is, I think. Going slow on that. A lot of people would like him to move quicker on that.
Arlene, how reliant is the city of Boston on action by the state legislature or the governor in order to solve its really hyper-intense transportation woes inside the city of Boston?
It's huge, because the vast majority of the traffic is coming from outside the city, from people who don't live here. And the city, even though it's become a wealthier city than ever before, simply won't have the finances to deal with that. And so much of it is about public transportation, which is an MBTA state-run entity.
So this was a moment that stood out for me that night on transportation.
And I'm calling once again for the city of Boston to have a seat on the MBTA board. Our city and our residents are the largest taxpayers into the MBTA. This is Boston, and we've never been big fans of taxation without representation. You deserve a voice.
That drew, as you can hear, a big response from the crowd, Joe. And, you know, it was interesting because, as I said before, Governor Baker was right there. Mm-hmm. And Mayor Walsh and Governor Baker have long had a strong relationship. But that was a throwdown. So are we seeing a shift over because of transportation in that relationship? And will that actually be more effective over time in getting things solved? Or does that tension undermine what Mayor Walsh is trying to do?
I don't think it undermines it. I think what Walsh is trying to do is emphasize, he's mentioned this before about wanting the state to have a seat on the MBTA board. So that wasn't new, the fact that he did it right there in his speech and, you know, had the little joke with it, I think it got people's attention on it. But again, if he really wanted to be bold, he could have endorsed, say, free bus rides by the MBTA, an idea that's being pushed by some city councilors, but he didn't.
And I believe Lowell has
far.
Been experimenting with it on at least one bus line for the last 2 years. Are we pushing far enough in the city, Arlene? You know, Joe says, hey, if you're really serious, maybe make the buses free. Are there other things we should be pushing for that we're not?
Unfortunately, we're so overly dependent on the state to solve this problem for us and for the region that really no mayor can do anything other than beg the state.
And actually, I want to correct. I said Lowell, and I meant to say Lawrence. It's there that they've got a bus line that's been almost 2 years in a pilot program providing that bus transportation.
And I think
free.
It's worked, too.
But the early returns seem to have been good. And, you know, various levels of free MBTA are something we've heard from different city council members. We've talked about it here on the show before. I want to move to hubbubs in just a second. But one word from each of you on education. The mayor, you know, extra $100 million in funding. What's the big priority in education, Arlene, in your mind for the next couple of years?
I think he's doing the right thing. I'm glad he's putting more money in. And recent Globe articles show that one of the things that has to be dealt with are the deplorable conditions of the bathrooms. Because when a kid is sitting in a classroom unwilling, unable, and scared to go to the bathroom because it's disgusting or rodent-filled or broken, how do they learn in an environment like that?
You know, it's interesting. One of our commentators Tuesday night, the analyst, was Jennifer Nasur, who had just run for Boston City Council, and that was a theme she came back to two or three times in her comments. That specifically, I think that is something that's got parents in the city feeling quite strongly. How about you, Jim?
I mean, I've listened to several dozen of these State of the City speeches in my lifetime, and they always talk about education. The mayor always mentions education, says what a big priority it's going to be. I'm going to fund extra things or put extra funding in it, which Walsh did. But, you know, what we want to see are results. And, you know, like Arlene mentioned, doing things like cleaning up bathrooms and things like that, and making it more livable for students to learn it.
All right. So we'll be watching for that. But before we run out of time, let's turn to our hubbubs. We all love them. And we could use a little happy or interesting or trivia even at the end of this week. These are the brief stories or events that caught our attention. Arlene, why don't you go first?
Okay. On a totally unrelated topic for hubbub this week, I have an Arizona Republican lawmaker who has proposed legislation that includes a provision prohibiting the discussion of homosexuality in public schools.
Well, that is schools.
Yes, in schools. including, she would have them remove the word from all teaching materials. And by the way, this lawmaker is the chair of their education committee. So some people think that this is a reaction to the state of Arizona repealing something called the No Promo Homo Law from last year. No Promo Homo Laws are what we call laws that say you can't teach about AIDS and HIV in schools because that might promote the homosexual lifestyle. We dealt with this here in Massachusetts in the 80s and the 90s, and so Arizona is sort of three decades behind us. But this morning, the good news is that she announced because of all the news coverage about this, that she's going to back off and amend the bill to remove that provision. But I have to mention, if I may, this lawmaker comes from a town called Snowflake. Oh, you can't make this stuff up.
There's the irony. How about you, Joe?
I can actually top you, Arlene, on that one. A state senator in Vermont introduced a bill to actually ban cell phones from anybody under 21 years of age.
Oh, yeah, that's just not going to work.
No, well, you know, it's not going to work. The state senator even himself said, I probably won't even vote for it, which, you know, I thought we had wacky legislators in Massachusetts, but Vermont tops us on that. But I do think that some parents listening, including me, like might there's a kernel of truth in what he said, in that cell phones are destroying, you know, kids, a lot of kids' lives. The social media, the pressures that kids are under, it's really changed how it's growing up and made it much harder to grow up. And I don't think banning cell phones is a good idea, but, you know, I think a lot of parents might sympathize with it.
All right, so I'll go to mine now. You might not know this about me, but I love space stuff. So astronomers at Harvard have discovered the largest continuous gas structure known in the galaxy here in the Milky Way. Apparently, it's 9,000 light years long. The discoverers have named it the Radcliffe Wave, and it matters because it turns out that it means we didn't quite understand the role of the sun in the Milky Way the way we should have. It turns out it crossed the wave millions of years ago and will again. So as Bob Oakes of Morning Edition says,
what that apparently means is that as you sit quietly on that recliner in your home, you are actually galactically surfing the Radcliffe Wave. You are so dope.
Mostly, I just wanted everyone to get to hear that from Bob Oakes. All right, Joe Battenfeld, political columnist at the Boston Herald and host of Battenfeld on Boston Herald Radio. Thanks for being here
today. Thank you.
And Arlene Isaacson, president of Isaacson Political Consulting and co-chair of the Massachusetts Gay and Lesbian Political Caucus. Thanks to you as well.
Thank you.
And listeners... Yeah. Love it. Listeners, you are so dope. Thanks for calling in today. That's our show. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I am Tiziana Deering. The whole team thanks you for the week. And join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.
You are so dope.